myth of cowboy individualism became central to the culture of Republican politics. From 1981 to 2021, Republican policies moved more than $50 trillion from the bottom 90% of Americans to the top 1%. And the party stayed in power through media disinformation, voter suppression, gerrymandering, and the flood of money into politics. Those systemic changes to the political system in the United States moved the Republican Party farther and farther and farther right. And the rhetoric of cowboy individualism, as it did so, became more and more extreme.
That's Heather Cox Richardson, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Heather Cox Richardson on cowboy authoritarianism in America. We are at an inflection point. A chill is sweeping the country. We ignore it at our peril. The warning signs are everywhere. Alaska GOP Senator Lisa Murkowski says, "We are all afraid." Massachusetts Democratic Governor Maura Healey says, "The fear is real." New York Times columnist Marsha Gessen writes, "America's police state has arrived." Dissent is being criminalized. People are being deported without due process. Court rulings are being ignored. Democracy, civil liberties, and free speech are all under attack. What can be done to reverse cowboy authoritarianism in America? Our guest today is Heather Cox Richardson. She's professor of history at Boston College. She previously taught at MIT. Her newsletter, Letters from an American, reaches more than a million readers. She spoke at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver on April 10, 2025. The moderator is UBC Professor Heidi Twarick. And now, Heather Cox Richardson.
I wanted to talk today about what's happening in the United States and to address this question of what it means to be an American in 2025. I'm going to argue today that the crisis in today's United States is the logical outcome of 40 years of a Republican ideology that was based in the idea of cowboy individualism. That idea has directed American politics since 1980, at least, when President Ronald Reagan wrote it to the White House. Those people who embrace cowboy individualism believe that a true American is a man who operates on his own, outside the community. He needs nothing from the government. He works hard to support himself. He protects his wife and his children, and he asserts his will by dominating others. That ideology is rooted in the mythological image of the American cowboy who began to drive cattle from the border of Texas and Mexico north across the plains to army posts and railheads in 1866. That image sprang to prominence in the years immediately after the Civil War, and in that peculiar moment, it took on a specific anti-government meaning. A political meaning. The Civil War government in the United States set out to protect black Americans from persecution by their white neighbors in the American South. In 1868, the 14th Amendment to the Constitution guaranteed equal protection of the laws to formerly enslaved people. And then 2 years later, in 1870, Congress created the Department of Justice to prosecute those people who attacked black Americans because of their race. So with the federal government suddenly willing to prosecute racial discrimination, former Confederates turned their racial animosity into an economic argument. Beginning in 1871, they claimed that the government's effort to protect civil rights was tantamount to socialism, because the government officials it required to protect Black Americans cost tax dollars. And those tax dollars could only come from hardworking white men in the years after the Civil War. And they were providing that money to provide benefits for undeserving, they said, Black people. Southern Democrats after the war contrasted that government socialism, as they called it, with the image of the American cowboy, who, in their view, was a young white man who wanted nothing from the government but to be left alone. The cowboy, in their view, was hardworking, he was good with a gun, and he dominated the women and the racial minorities he encountered in the West. That myth countered the idea that the government should protect all Americans equally. The cowboy image actually faded in the early 20th century progressive era, which is itself an interesting story. But it sprang back to prominence in the 1950s and the 1960s as a propaganda tool to oppose the wildly popular post-World War II government. That government reflected the idea that government had a role to play in regulating business, in providing a basic social safety net, in promoting infrastructure, and in protecting civil rights. And those people who were determined to get rid of government regulation and taxation resurrected the myth of the American cowboy, and they championed this idea of cowboy individualism. They embraced the idea that a government that worked for ordinary Americans was a form of socialism, because it redistributed wealth from hardworking white people to Black Americans, people of color, and women who demanded equal rights. The Republicans nominated Arizona Senator Barry Goldwater, who was famous for his cowboy persona and his white cowboy hat and his opposition to the post-war government. They nominated him for president. And then, of course, in 1980, Ronald Reagan put aside his British riding clothes, put on a Western cowboy hat, and rode that ideology to the White House. That myth of cowboy individualism became central to the culture of Republican politics as a way for Republican politicians to convince voters to support the destruction of federal government programs that actually benefited them. From 1981 to 2021, Republican policies moved more than $50 trillion from the bottom 90% of Americans to the top 1%. And the party stayed in power through media disinformation, voter suppression, gerrymandering, and the flood of money into politics. Those systemic changes to the political system in the United States moved the Republican Party farther and farther and farther right. And the rhetoric of cowboy individualism, as it did so, became more and more extreme. They demonized non-white Americans and women in the public sphere, and they dismissed all government policies that promoted social cooperation, whether at home or abroad. And in place of the post-World War II idea of cooperation among equals, they replaced that idea with the idea that individual men should dominate society, ordering it as they thought best. Over time, white men rejected the socialization and the education that would enable them to rise to prosperity or to develop meaningful relationships. That domination to which they turned at the heart of cowboy individualism grew increasingly apparent in the United States after 1992, when the modern militia movement took off after a standoff at Ruby Ridge, Idaho, between federal marshals and a former factory worker named Randy Weaver, who had failed to show up to court for a trial on a firearms charge, convinced a number of Western men that they had to arm themselves to fight off the government. By the early 2000s in the U.S., gun ownership first became a symbol of cultural identity, and then it became a way to groom younger people into Republican political ideology. This is why we see political leaders posing with their families holding AR-15s on Christmas cards. The Trump administration has taken cowboy individualism now to an extreme, I believe, gutting the U.S. government and centering power in a dominant president, while also pulling the United States out of the web of international organizations that have stabilized the globe since World War II. The administration began its run in 2025 by firing the women and the racial and gender minorities who held positions in the government, but it is not just exercising domination over others, it is reveling in that dominance and advertising it, especially over the migrants it has sent to prison in El Salvador, showing films of them being transported in chains and displaying caged prisoners behind Homeland Security Kristi Noem, who in those photographs and in that film is wearing a $50,000 gold Rolex watch. In place of cooperation, the Trump administration's determination to exercise its dominance shows, I think, in its plan to invest $1 trillion in the military after gutting the U.S. Agency for International Development, also known as USAID. Trump has always seen power as a zero-sum game in which for one party to win, others must lose. If, in fact, Trump succeeds in asserting his dominance over the United States of America and over the globe, the Republicans will have succeeded in replacing American democracy with a dictatorship, and they will have rebalanced global power. But, you know with me there's always a but, right? Those who believe in that ideology of cowboy individualism have not yet established that autocracy that is their endgame, in large part because that cowboy ideology is a myth. It has never reflected reality. And right now, MAGA Republicans are watching in real time as their president, Donald Trump, lumps them in with the minorities and people of color they believed were inferior to them. The government programs that Republicans are calling wasteful are not just the ones that supported racial minorities. They are the ones that supported MAGA Republicans. Cowboy individualism was always a myth. It never represented the United States of America. It didn't even represent the cowboys, one-third of whom were black or were men of color, and whose employment actually replicated the low pay and dangerous conditions of Eastern factory workers. In fact, the American West was a multicultural world in which the key to surviving and even prospering was not dominating other people, it was kinship ties and communities. Famous Western trader Kit Carson, for example, often lionized as the real hero of cowboy individualism, spoke English, Spanish, a number of indigenous languages, and was married three times, two times to an indigenous woman and then to a Mexican woman. When Eastern settlers moved west, they depended on communities to enable them to survive disasters because, for example, every single farm would lose a barn to fire at some point, and you needed to have people for barn raising. That focus on communities in the American West gave the United States of America grassroots political movements, which were named, after all, for the prairie grasses, whose roots can go as deep as 3.5 meters. Those movements included the late 19th century Alliance Movement and the populist movements in the late 19th century that reordered American politics. Central to those movements, those grassroots movements, were the Western women who organized to fund churches and to fund schools and who drove Western politics. For example, when the Western state of Iowa added murals to its state house in 1908 to portray the modern government, the duties of defense, charities, education, and the executive, legislative, and the judiciary, it illustrated those aspects of modern American government, all except defense and legislature, it portrayed them as women. The contrast between the myth of cowboy individualism and the reality of life in the American West matters because they represent two very different versions of the American government. Iowa's depiction of the modern government as support for an inclusive society in which women took full part was part of a larger movement in the early 20th century to change the nature of American government itself. Key to that change was social worker Frances Perkins, which is why you've been hearing so much about her from me lately. As a Settlement House worker, she saw firsthand what economists will tell you today, that modern industrialization could not survive without the labor and the participation of the entire community, not just male factory workers, who were actually paid lower than survival wages. Later, when she witnessed the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire in 1911, Perkins also saw what happened to communities without government regulation and social services. I can't begin to tell you how disturbed the people were everywhere, Perkins recalled after the fire. It was as though we had all done something wrong. It shouldn't have been. We were sorry. We didn't want it that way. We hadn't intended to have 147 girls and boys killed in a factory. It was a terrible thing for the people of the city of New York and the state of New York to face. With her help, the New York Democratic machine remade New York state politics to address the needs of the entire community. When Perkins became Secretary of Labor under Franklin Delano Roosevelt, she took that new government philosophy to the federal level, where she ushered in a dramatic change to the nature of the federal government. With the 1935 Social Security Act, Perkins did more than provide benefits for the elderly and orphans. She created a new kind of United States government. Before Perkins, the primary function of the federal government was to manage the economic relationships between labor, capital, and resources. Property rights, after all, had been the basis on which North American colonists had found the justification, the legal justification, to rebel against the British Crown. And the focus on the relationships inherent in property ownership had continued to dominate the government that American lawmakers built afterward. But Perkins recognized that the end of government was not to protect property. It was to protect the communities of people who lived in the nation. She recognized that children, the elderly, women, and disabled Americans were as valuable to that community as the young male workers and the wealthy men who employed them. And she molded the government to reflect the idea that the equal value of all Americans meant that they should all have equal protection of the laws and equal access to resources, including social services like health care, education, and child care. Her vision of the U.S. government reflected reality. But Perkins' recognition of community as the heart of the nation directly challenged the power of men who could dominate a world that had been defined by economic relationships. As soon as the Social Security Act passed, opponents worked to destroy it and the new idea of government that it represented. Reaching back to the past, they claimed that such a government would destroy men's willingness to work and ruin the individualism that made America great. In the 1930s, as soon as the New Deal reorganized government around communities, established businessmen set out to resurrect that old form of government, that old economic ideology. And to bolster their support, they welcomed racists who opposed the idea of equal rights for racial and ethnic minorities to their coalition, and that unholy alliance has been well studied. But they also turned to religious traditionalists who had stood against the teaching of evolution in the Scopes trial just a dozen years before the passage of the Social Security Act. Religious traditionalists, especially those in the Southern Baptist Convention, opposed the new system because it recognized equal rights for women. Women's equality, they believed, meant the end of the patriarchy that they thought mirrored God's relationship to his people, and they saw it as an affront to God. Their position that the modern government was un-American then was strengthened in 1962 when the Supreme Court decided the Engle v. Vitale decision, which struck down state-mandated prayer in public schools, and then in 1963 when Abingdon School District v. Shemp prohibited teachers from leading students in prayer or Bible readings. The Supreme Court decisions against prayer in the schools reinforced the idea that the modern government opposed family values. That religious traditionalism took political shape in 1967 when Southern Baptist leaders Paul Pressler and Paige Patterson plotted to take the Southern Baptists back to an older view of the world. They focused on the inerrancy of the Bible, that is, the Bible can't be wrong, but it was really about women's rights, their ideology. They were denying women's equality and pushing them back into a position subordinate to men. By 1972, the issue of abortion would bring this sexist religious backlash into American politics. Abortion had become a centerpiece of the post-World War II government after doctors identified abortion access as a major public health issue in the 1960s. They estimated that there were between 200,000 and 1.2 million illegal U.S. abortions a year, endangering the lives of women, primarily poor women who could not afford a workaround. By 1972, 64% of Americans believed that abortion should be a question answered by a woman and her doctor. 68% of Republicans believed that. But in 1972, before Roe v. Wade, President Richard Nixon was up for re-election, and he and his people were terrified that he would lose the election. So his advisor Pat Buchanan urged Nixon to woo Catholic Democrats before the election by turning to the issue of abortion. Although Nixon had virtually the same platform on the issue as Democratic nominee George McGovern, Nixon and Buchanan defined McGovern as the candidate of acid, amnesty for draft dodgers, and abortion, a radical framing designed to attract traditionalists to the Republican Party. As Nixon split the U.S. in two to rally voters, his supporters used abortion to stand in for women's rights in general. Railing against women's equal rights, in her first statement on abortion in 1972, again the year before Roe versus Wade, activist Phyllis Schlafly did not talk about fetuses, but she talked about women's equality. Women's Lib, short for Women's Liberation, is a total assault on the role of the American woman as wife and mother, and on the family as the basic unit of society. Women's Libbers are trying to make wives and mothers unhappy with their career, make them feel that they are second-class citizens and abject slaves. They are promoting federal daycare centers for babies instead of homes. They are promoting abortions instead of families. In 1979, the first deadline for the passage of the Equal Rights Amendment enshrining women's rights in the U.S. Constitution passed with the amendment unratified, and candidate Ronald Reagan welcomed right-wing Southern Baptist leaders like Pat Robertson, Billy Graham, and Jerry Falwell into his coalition. As the power of those evangelicals grew, Republican culture attacked the modern government by relegating women to the roles of wives and mothers or as sex objects. With talk radio hosts like Rush Limbaugh referring to women who wanted equal rights as feminazis who were destroying society, and after 1996, the Fox News Channel portrayed women's ideal submissive role quite carefully as younger women deferred to older white male hosts like Bill O'Reilly and displayed their bodies under low-cut shirts and short skirts that could be seen under the new glass desks that they used on those sets. But this attempt to undermine the modern government was running up against women's changing political voice. American women tended to vote as their husbands did until 1980, when political observers first saw a gender gap in voting. Women turn out in higher numbers to vote than men do, and at higher rates, and they vote for Democratic candidates at higher rates than men do. If you break that statistic down by race, the numbers are even starker, with black women and women of color voting in significantly higher percentages for Democratic candidates than men do. So the attempt to get rid of the modern American state began to take shape as an evangelical emphasis on gender domination in households. Wildly popular books and religious culture emphasized a woman's duty to produce a lot of children and to do as her husband or father told her. In 2014 and 2015, this impulse to remove the equality of women from American society showed in Gamergate, when men complained about their inability to find women who would date them and began to call themselves incels or involuntary celibates and began to refer to women as NPCs, non-player characters, who are there to make the story move forward for the playing characters. By the way, a term that you see Elon Musk using a lot these days. When you see NPCs, that's what he's talking about. In the 2016 campaign, Republican candidate Donald Trump faced off against Hillary Clinton, who had so specifically defended the idea of a community-based government that she wrote a book titled It Takes a Village. Trump demonstrated his dominance over Clinton by physically looming over her at a debate. He called for her to be jailed, and then he boasted of sexual assault. But that boast of sexual assault did not end his candidacy, it strengthened it, as a certain group of Republicans saw attacks on women as attacks on the government that they hated. Once in power, Trump gave the evangelicals what they wanted by stacking the Supreme Court with justices who would overturn abortion rights. In 2025, Trump returned to power by warning voters that the modern American state was literally turning boys into girls, while his vice president, J.D. Vance, urged women to embrace traditional gender roles, including staying in abusive marriages for the sake of the children. In contrast, Democratic candidates, Vice President Kamala Harris and Minnesota Governor Tim Walz, emphasized community and the role of government in protecting that community.
You're listening to Heather Cox Richardson on Cowboy Authoritarianism in America. This is Independent Alternative Radio. For copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977 or online, our website, alternativeradio.org.
Now, Trump's MAGA Republicans control all the branches of the government. But it is not clear that they will be able to suppress the vast majority of Americans who continue to support the government that Francis Perkins ushered in 90 years ago. For one thing, Republican voters are learning that the government they thought was helping women and minorities actually helps them and kept the nation safe. But there's also a key factor at play right now that is coming to a conclusion after the long-standing Republican attacks on women. As they did in Perkins's era, women are still central to the American community, but now there is a twist. Two generations of women striving for education meant that men backed away from professions once women reached parity in those professions, and now women are dominating educational achievement in the United States, making them more prepared for a modern government than young men are. The past 40 years has also created a new demographic. Women now have educations and connections, they have skills, often they have money, and the people who are now in the boomer generation and slightly below it are the first generation of American women to have 20 to 30 years after their children leave home to invent a second career. Many of them are turning to issues they care about, including political organizing. Indeed, so nervous are MAGA Republican leaders about women's political roles that they're trying to throw women out of political power altogether. The House passed the Safeguard American Voter Eligibility, or the SAVE Act, which would require all American voters to prove they are citizens by presenting documentation in person when registering to vote or updating their voter registration information. But the kicker is that your official identification has to match your current name. That means that it would disfranchise as many as 69 million American women who do not have passports and whose birth certificates are not in their current married names. That SAVE Act, I think, dovetails with the extraordinary misogyny that has come to dominate the MAGA Republican Party. And I'm going to argue that it is not an accident that the current attempt in the United States to overthrow democracy presents as an attack on American women. American women created and then maintained the American state the Trump administration is currently dismantling.